Vice President Spiro Agnew, one of the most controversial political figures of the 1960s and 1970s, in his own words and those of his detractors. That's our focus on this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. I'm King David McKenzie.
I'll sing a song about the president. What's his name? the guy with 81% of the people in back of him. I mean, you don't know what to believe anymore because the television just spews forward lies. You know, it's such a rapid rate now. Cancerous rate. They can't control it. They can't even cover up their own tracks now. They used to be able to do that. Time out for a commercial, but there's two Americas. There's an old America, which is just dying and ossifying, growing harder and collapsing. And as it dies, the people just get uglier and uglier. After they assassinated Kennedy, you know, got him out of the picture, John Kennedy, ugly Johnson comes in. They had to get somebody uglier than that, so they got ugly Nixon. And Nixon had to get uglier to back him up, you know. So
spiral.
So none of it's true. It's all a Madison Avenue dream, or really nightmare.
I, for one, don't even believe that he's president, because in order to have a president, you have to have an election. In order to have an election, you have to have a choice. And if you remember back to the primaries, there were people that were running against the war, Kennedy and McCarthy, who won often 85 to 90% of the vote. But when it came time for the parties to pick their candidates, that was totally ignored. So in point of fact, there really was no election. For a man that's always wanted to be president, now that he's president, he's not even president.
It was a used car dealer's election, and the choice was rather small. The boys agreed it's the war we need, so there's no president at all. Here's to Nixon and Agnew, they are the stars of the stage and screen. Not since Laurel and Hardy have I laughed so hard I've screamed. I thought that Johnson was the devil. I thought we couldn't do no worse. Now the White House stands in Disneyland. This country must be under a curse. Here's to Nixon and Agnew. They are the stars of the stage and screen. Not since Laurel and Hardy have I laughed so hard I screamed. I dreamed Nixon died of a suntan. There was only Spiro left. At his swearing in, he fell on his chin. He assassinated himself. Here's to Nixon and Agnew. They are the stars of the stage and screen. It's not since Laurel.
Phil Oakes, with a song from his 1970 album Greatest Hits, 10 Cents a Coup. It's fairly safe to say that Spiro Agnew, then the 39th Vice President of the United States, had even less use for Oakes's opinion. The governor of Maryland at the time he was nominated as Richard Nixon's Republican ticket mate in the 1968 presidential election, Agnew immediately became a hero to the so-called radical right, so much so that RCA Victor Records issued a 1971 album of excerpts from Agnew's speeches, which were often written by future commercial media pundits William Sapphire and Pat Buchanan. The liner notes on that album said to potential buyers that Agnew spoke out on, quoting now, "radicalism in our midst, Vietnam War critics, protesters, malcontents, hippies and defeatism, television's responsibilities, and the Republican and Democratic parties." End of quote. One subject that Agnew was silent on at the time was his alleged extortion, tax fraud, and acceptance of $29,500 in bribes while governor of Maryland. He was charged with these crimes by U.S. Attorney General Elliot Richardson in October of 1973, leading to Agnew's resignation on October 10th, just before pleading nolo contendere to the tax evasion charge. He was the first U.S. vice president to resign because of criminal activity. The only other vice president to resign, John C. Calhoun, who had served under John Quincy Adams and Andrew Jackson, quit to take a seat in the Senate. It may make sense to keep that in mind while we hear his words on that RCA Victor album.
Ladies and gentlemen, Vice President Agnew speaks out on the problems and issues confronting America today.
What is the greatest issue today? It's not the war in Vietnam. It's not inflation, nor the environment. It's not an issue that you even hear discussed in its stark and simple enormity. But it is nonetheless the overriding and compelling issue in the United States today. Simply stated, it is, will the government of this country remain in the hands of its elected officials, or will it descend to the streets? It is not unusual, nor should it be distressing, that individuals of monumental ego among the failures of our society should attack everything fundamental to our free culture. They're simply lashing out in all directions because they cannot bear to face their individual inadequacies. Neither should it overly concern us that certain brilliant but sequestered academicians are criticizing the government. This has always been so, and probably always will be so. Sometimes it even does some good.
The vice president focuses on the irresponsible attacks from a small segment of our society.
But I want you to know that I will not make a unilateral withdrawal and thereby abridge the confidence of the silent majority. The everyday, law-abiding American who believes in his country needs a strong voice to articulate his dissatisfaction with those who seek to destroy our heritage of liberty and our system of justice, to penetrate the cacophony of seditious drivel emanating from the best publicized clowns in our society and their fans in the Fourth Estate. Yes, my friends, to penetrate that drivel, we need a cry of alarm, not a whisper.
In answer to the attacks of these dissenters, the vice president states,
and if the hippies and the yippies and the disruptors of the systems that Washington and Lincoln as presidents brought forth in this country will shut up and work within our free system of government, I will lower my voice. And if the Black Panther Party will disclaim its publicized purpose of violence and overthrow of our elected government by force and will run candidates for election in the traditional Democratic fashion, I will lower my voice. And if the SDS and the RAM and the PLP will transfer their allegiance from Mao Zedong and Castro and the Viet Cong to the United States of America, I will subside to a more professorial tone.
The Vice President has the following comments on the bizarre times in which we live.
Sometimes it appears that we're reaching a period when our senses and our minds will no longer respond to moderate stimulation. We seem to be approaching an age of the gross. Persuasion through speeches and books is too often discarded for disruptive demonstrations aimed at bludgeoning the unconvinced into action. The young, and by this, I don't mean by any stretch of the imagination all the young, but I'm talking about those who claim to speak for the young. At the zenith of physical power and sensitivity, overwhelm themselves with drugs and artificial stimulants. subtlety is lost, and fine distinctions based on acute reasoning are carelessly ignored in a headlong jump to a predetermined conclusion. Life is visceral rather than intellectual, and the most visceral practitioners of life are those who characterize themselves as intellectuals. Truth is to them revealed rather than logically proved. And the principal infatuations of today revolve around the social sciences, those subjects which can accommodate any opinion and about which the most reckless conjecture cannot be discredited. Education is being redefined at the demand of the uneducated to suit the ideas of the uneducated. The student now goes to college to proclaim rather than to learn. The lessons of the past are ignored and obliterated in a contemporary antagonism known as the generation gap. A spirit of national masochism prevails, encouraged by an effete core of impudent snobs who characterize themselves as intellectuals. Why then, if these political phenomena are standard to a democratic government, should we be disturbed about them today? The answer lies not in the fear of kooks or demagogues themselves, but in their current respectability. Never in our history have we paid so much attention to so many odd characters. 25 years ago, the tragicomic antics of such societal misfits would have brought the establishment running after them with butterfly nets rather than television cameras. It's in this inordinate attention to the bizarre, this preoccupation with the dramatic, this rationalization of the ridiculous, that we threaten the progress of our nation. I believe that physical confrontation cannot be a productive substitute for debate. I believe that men of goodwill and intent must sit down with each other to solve problems, not to act in the theater of public opinion.
In defense of the courts of the land, the Vice President has the following to say.
Gentlemen, I propose that all of us elected to positions of governmental responsibility should speak out forcefully and directly against the outrageous patterns of conduct which have become so fashionable of late. Whether or not one agrees with every ruling that the judge made in the recent Chicago trial is not the point. The point is that a handful of oddballs deliberately set out to politicize a simple criminal proceeding and to disrupt the most basic protection of our society, the dignity of the courts. The point is that the new technique of judicial disruption is spreading like wildfire throughout the country. The tactic is to provoke and inflame in the hope that overreaction will obliterate the true nature of the proceeding.
The Democratic Party has not been neglected by Vice President Agnew.
To hear the party that piled up $58 billion of deficits and created the worst inflation this country ever had complain about the purchasing power of the dollar just tugged at my heartstrings. To hear the publishers of the Great Society and the New Frontier complain about spending was like hearing germs complain about disease. To listen to the party that sent over 500,000 men to Vietnam decry the rate of our disengagement is a bit like lighting a fire and then criticizing the firemen. Let's not forget, my friends, that it was the policies of these same Democrats that sparked the wave of lawlessness and permissiveness that brought the United States to the verge of civil disorder. We've had 8 years of their non-leadership. And we now have a leader of courage and vision in the White House. And already they're carping that the mess hasn't been cleaned up. Well, it's pretty hard to clean a floor when a bunch of muddy-footed opposition congressmen keep tracking through the kitchen looking for the cookie jar. That's one of the differences that's always struck me between the Democratic and the Republican parties. The Democrats are always trying to spend their way out of America's imagined difficulties, while the Republicans are always trying to find ways to pay bills run up by the Democrats. But it seems like every time we get the bills paid, they come in on another set of freewheeling, fancy promises and run up a new set of debts.
And finally, in answer to America's detractors,
our answer today is the same as the answer in the days of Washington and Lincoln. Let the forces of logic and reason continue to shine strongly. Let the people who made the United States a great nation continue to bequeath it to those who will make it greater. And let the few, the very few, who would desecrate their own house be made fully aware of our utter contempt.
The Vice President's reputation for wit is well-deserved, often at his own expense.
I enjoyed my recent visits to our Asian embassies. 8 of them still had windows. I knew I did fairly well when Bob Hope told me that he thought it was a little much that I waited ashore at Manila. And I remember an experience President Nixon had with his schedule. He picked it up one day, and it had this scenario. It said, President Nixon will speak for 10 minutes, following which his remarks will be translated into English. Well, I knew we had a trouble communicating sometimes. I didn't think it was that bad. But I think the funniest thing that happened to me over there was the intensity of the coverage. Judy and I were going through a temple in Bangkok. And you had to remove your shoes. And as we came out, I went to put my shoes on, and one of the photographers followed me right down to the chair and then down onto the floor with his camera about that far off the floor. And he was focusing on my foot as I was putting my shoe on. Well, I could understand that had certain human interest. But then a radio reporter rushed down to me with a microphone. And he got down the floor and he kept holding the microphone up to my foot. I guess he thought that instead of putting my foot in my mouth, I might have my mouth in my foot.
And of course, sometimes it is turned on others.
Lyndon Johnson, who was elected to a high office. At least I think he was elected to a high office. If I read a few more memoirs of Kennedy aides, I may find that he never existed at all.
Our Asian policy is explained by Vice President Agnew.
And I found approbation and understanding of the new Nixon doctrine, a doctrine that says, yes, the United States is a Pacific power. The United States will continue to be involved in the welfare of Asia. The United States will provide a nuclear screen to protect these countries against nuclear attack by a superpower. But the United States will not be a father. The United States will be a partner to stimulate regional cooperation and economic growth. And as I went around to the various Asian nations, I found a fear that some limited defeat on a South Vietnamese outfit would have the effect of beginning a new wave of anti-war furor in the United States. We want to get out honorably and quickly. And the people of this country have shown that they are behind the president in this.
And in answer to its critics, the vice president says,
when I see a United States senator travel to Paris and engage in secret conversations with the enemy at a time when he should be reinforcing the solidarity of our effort to bring an end to that conflagration, it makes me wonder what the people in that state were thinking of when they sent that man to the Senate.
Senator Fulbright said some months ago that if the Vietnam War went on much longer, the best of our young people would be in Canada. Well, I'd just as soon let Senator Fulbright go prospecting for his future party leaders in the deserters' dens of Canada and Sweden. We Republicans will look elsewhere. Indeed, as for these deserters, malcontents, radicals, incendiaries, the civil and the uncivil disobedience among our young, SDS, PLP, Weatherman 1, Weatherman 2, the Revolutionary Action Movement, Panthers, Lions, Hippies, Yippies, Tigers alike, I'd rather swap the whole damn zoo for a single platoon of the kind of young Americans I saw in Vietnam.
Vice President offers these observations on the administration and the future of the Republican Party.
The administration has moved from the defensive to the offensive. We are not going to sit back and wait for this earth to be destroyed or go out with band-aids to patch gaping wounds. We are going to plan and prevent. We are going to stop problems before they start. But in spite of intelligent executive initiative, in spite of some gains, in the end, we come to one basic truth. A president can propose, but only Congress can dispose. A Congress bent on political rationalization of its acts, a Congress dedicated to creating failures for its president, is not a Congress for these difficult and perilous times. Your president deserves a Republican Congress with leadership dedicated to the success, not to the failure, of his administration. Yes, and we want the young voters who want to do something more than talk about what's wrong with the system. We want those who want to change things from within, and we say to them, come along with us. We want those Democrats, of whom I spoke earlier, who've been dispossessed by their national leadership. We want those who believe that the principles which unite us as citizens are greater than the economic, ethnic, or regional interests which divide us as individuals. In 1970, we have a message to get across to the people of this country. The Republican Party is ready, willing, and able to provide leadership. It is more interested in people's principles than their politics. Forget past labels and look at our logic. We are not the party which tears America down. We are the party which wants to build America up. I look upon the youth of today, of every place and creed, as a fountainhead of ideas, as an infinite reservoir of knowledge containing energy of solar dimensions. All of our hopes for the future are with them. We need them in the Republican Party. I would hope that the wayward few will cast off the blanket of filth and confusion the dependency on drugs and artificial stimulants, that they will shed their negative thesis and return to the pursuit and in time, yes, to the realization of the American ideal.
The Vice President points out an area of power and of the responsibility that should go with that power.
The purpose of my remarks tonight is to focus your attention on this little group of men who not only enjoy a right of instant rebuttal to every presidential address, but more importantly, wield a free hand in selecting, presenting, and interpreting the great issues in our nation. Monday night, a week ago, President Nixon delivered the most important address of his administration, one of the most important of our decade. His subject was Vietnam. My hope, as his, at that time, was to rally the American people, to see the conflict through to a lasting and just peace in the Pacific. For 32 minutes, he reasoned with a nation that has suffered almost a third of a million casualties in the longest war in its history. When the president completed his address, an address, incidentally, that he spent weeks in the preparation of, his words and policies were subjected to instant analysis and querulous criticism. The audience of 70 million Americans gathered to hear the President of the United States was inherited by a small band of network commentators and self-appointed analysts, the majority of whom expressed in one way or another their hostility to what he had to say. Now, every American has a right to disagree with the President of the United States and to express publicly that disagreement. But the President of the United States has a right to communicate directly with the people who elected him. And the people of this country have the right to make up their own minds and form their own opinions about a presidential address without having the president's words and thoughts characterized through the prejudices of hostile critics before they can even be digested.
To those who show a lack of faith in America's principles, the vice president has these closing comments.
I believe that this matter of approach on the part of educators is one of more importance than ever in these times when there's such an extreme concentration on the negative. We're constantly bombarded with strident cries of what's wrong with America. And this has led too many people to believe that this great country is in the grip of anarchy, panic, repression, or despair. Now, fortunately, you know and I know that this just isn't so. And let every American be assured that it's not going to be so. This should and will continue to be a society of great expectations. As we go forward into the 70s, we must and we will see more of these expectations become realities. We will preserve and we will enlarge the American dream. We will nourish and we will refresh the American spirit. We will enhance the quality of life for all Americans. And we will prove once again that in America, the voices of despair are ultimately stilled by the clear fact of progress.
In closing, let me say simply that I'm growing terribly weary of America's noisy detractors. This is such a terrible place to live. If our government is so oppressive and inept, then why is there an endless waiting list of people seeking to emigrate to America? Why doesn't the so-called brain drain of Europe's brightest scientists and technicians moving to the U.S. to work run in the opposite direction? Today, we, the people of America, should vow to emphasize what is right, what is decent, and what is good about our great country.
When Spiro Agnew identified his perceived adversaries by name, the effect could be somewhat swift. Only a matter of weeks after Agnew singled out ABC anchorman Frank Reynolds for particular criticism, Reynolds was relieved of his duties as co-anchor of the television network's evening news program and replaced with former 60 Minutes reporter Harry Reasoner. And when award-winning author Harlan Ellison wrote a column for the Los Angeles Free Press containing a somewhat scatological reference to Agnew, Ellison's publisher was pressured by the White House to recall his then-current book, The Glass Teat, and refused to publish his follow-up volume, The Other Glass Teat. Those titles were eventually reintroduced to the marketplace, but in 1975, after Nixon and Agnew were gone from the White House, under disgraceful circumstances. That did not keep comics from spoofing Agnew on phonograph record, however. In a few moments, we'll be hearing about 20 minutes from a 1970 album titled Spiro T. Agnew is a Riot, featuring the talents of Rich Little, Vincent Price, Earl Dowd, Joanne Flug, Pat McCormick, Jack Riley, and, as Agnew, Stanley Myron Handelman. But first, from the 1973 album The Watergate Comedy Hour, we'll be hearing impressionist Frank Welker as both Agnew and a certain CBS News anchorman, renamed for the purposes of this project.
Good evening, everyone. This is Walter Mischkite. And tonight, we have an interview with the Vice President. Mr. Agnew, you've only recently spoke out on the events here in Washington, and it was a very brief statement of loyalty. Would you care to expand on the statement at this time?
Well, let me say here and now that I don't intend to stand idly by while some of the more self-serving members of the Fourth Estate try to crucify this man or myself because of my association with them. Now, let me reiterate, I have only the highest respect and admiration for him, and we discussed candidly and openly the possible political ramifications for 1976. Now, let me say once again, and for the last time, I will resign before I ever criticize my leader.
Then I take it that you support him fully?
Well, how could anyone not support him? Why, when he got up the other night and sang, "Fly me to the moon," there wasn't a dry eye in the house.
Excuse me, Mr. Agnew, but are you talking about the chief of state?
Hell no. The chairman of the board. Scooby-dooby-doo. La-dee-dee-da-dee.
Well, first of all, let me say this. I need a man who knows how to make a speech. I think that's very important. A man who knows a lot of hard words.
Well, we've checked all the possibilities, Mr. Nixon, and we've settled on the one man who we feel can reach the silent majority and tell it like it is at the same time. Now, I'd like you to hear Spiro T. Agnew. I know he's your man. He's giving a speech tonight to the local PTA.
Well, what are his credentials?
Well, this man started out from nothing, and in 10 years, he worked himself up to a position of being the present head of a Baltimore chapter of the PTA. Now, let's see what you think, huh?
Ladies and gentlemen, our guest speaker, the honored president of the Delancey and Crown Streets chapter of the PTA. Mr. Spiro T. Agnew.
All right, thank you. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and detractors.
Oh, he's good. He's very good.
You Before I begin the formal part of my talk, I would like to say a few words. Tomentos, formidable. Propitiate and forensic. These words usually don't come up in my talk, so I thought I'd get them across right away. This being the 17th anniversary of the closing of the B&O Railroad, I've been asked to say a few words about William Shakespeare, and I'd just like to say that he was really great. I don't want to create the impression that I'm giving this talk in order to sound arty or super intellectual. In fact, au contraire. You know what I mean? After all, this man wrote things that are just as pertinent today as they were last week. Here, listen to these words. What ho, ye merry swains? That was a question when he wrote it, and it's a question today. You know, speaking about a man like Shakespeare makes me realize how insignificant life really is. It's like when you're standing on the top of the Empire State Building and looking down at the people walking below. They look just like ants. Did you ever notice that? And in conclusion, I'd just like to sum up by pointing out that if Shakespeare were alive today, he would be well over 400 years old. Actually, he's better off. Thank you very much.
I want a man with a sense of humor. In these hard times, people need a little laugh. There's a great need for levity today. How is Agnew's wit?
Listen to this. Hey, Spiro, tell Dick the joke you told me this morning, huh?
Oh, okay, Mr. Nixon. That reminds me of a joke. This is not really a joke. It's more of a humorous anecdote. And it's one of my favorite humorous anecdotes. And I hope upon hearing it, it will become one of your favorite humorous anecdotes as well as my own.
Well, that's very funny. I like that.
He didn't tell the joke yet.
Oh.
I didn't create this joke. Rather, it comes from a book called Favorite Humorous Anecdotes. And this was originally told by one of America's outstanding humorists and presidents, James Polk. You'll have to excuse me if I laugh when I think about it, you know. I just heard it myself, you know.
Can we hear the joke, Spiro?
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. Anyway, this is the way it goes. It goes something like this. There's these three guys, see? Oh, no, I'm sorry. There were four guys.
Well, that's really a good joke. That's a start. Let me say this. Do you know any other jokes?
I don't think he's finished telling us this one yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yeah. But this is really it. There were these four guys, see? It's an Englishman, two Italians, and a German. And the Englishman and the German ordered curry shrimp, and the Italian ordered spaghetti with an antipasto. Now, the curry shrimp came to $3.90, and the spaghetti and the antipasto was $1.50 each. How much did the entire... Oh, I'm sorry. It's not a joke, it's a riddle. Yeah, I'm really awfully sorry. It happens to be a good riddle. You really had to hear Pope tell it.
I rather enjoyed the riddle.
President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew.
And it shall be my duty as Vice President of these United States not only to prosecute all those accused of crimes perpetrated within this country, but to defend with equal vigor the rights and privileges of most of its citizens. Now look, I'm going to tell you once and only once, and I don't want to have to repeat myself. I won't have this constant bickering and complaining and whining. You're old enough to know better. Learn to listen and not butt into things that don't concern you. You understand? Now, if I have to tell you this again, there's going to be real trouble around here. I don't like to scold you, and I don't like to sound mean, because I love you very much. But I have to draw the line somewhere. Now, be good and go right to bed. Good night.
This has been an address to the nation by the Vice President of the United States. Don Dumpy in the booth, about 3 minutes to fight time. Here are some statistics on the two boys. No time, down to ringside, and Johnny Abbott.
Ladies and gentlemen, your attention, please. The main event of the evening, 15 rounds duration for the verbal championship of the world. In the right corner, wearing the dark gray single-breasted Petrocelli suit with imported Italian shoes and maroon and black striped tie by Cassini from Baltimore, Maryland, with an IQ of 135, Spiro T. Agnew. In the other right corner, wearing the gray tweed slacks with a brown tweed jacket and white tweed shirt, with brown tweed loafers and blue tweed ties, from New York City, the volleyball champion of the world, William F. Buckley, Jr. Buckley. Main event, 15 rounds.
All right, you both know the rules. No proper names, no names of states, no slangs, no if-ands or buts. No mumbling in the clinches. Keep your words clean. All right, now shake hands, go to your corners, and come out talking. Don Dumpy again in the booth, bringing you another in the fabulous Gillette Cavalcades of Sports presentations. Stay tuned at the end of the fight for more details on up-and-coming sports events, all brought to you by the Gillette Safety Razor Company. Now, the bell round one. Both talkers come out fast to the center of the ring.
Neon fight.
Buckley leads with a one-syllable noun.
A feat.
A two-syllable adjective by Agnew.
Perspicious.
A two-syllable adjective by Buckley.
Rhetoric.
And Agnew is back with a two-syllable adverb. Both fighters dance around each other.
Sexagenarian.
A three-syllable adjective that stuns Agnew, and Agnew is blushing. The red in his face is clearly visible.
Nymphomaniac.
And there's a three-syllable adjective by Agnew, and there's the bell ending round one. Let's go down and see if we can pick up some of the conversation in Agnew's corner.
Listen to me, Sparrow. He's using a lot of four-syllable words, and he stops to think between words. You keep your words short, you hear? Keep jabbing him with short words. Wear him down, and then wait for the right time to hit him with anti-disestablishmentarianism. That'll put him away, and don't slur your vowels. You're slurring your vowels. You know, just keep them sharp.
Round two.
Vitriolic.
Agnew out first with a hard three-syllable adverb which seemed to catch Buckley off guard.
Sacrosanct.
Another three-syllable adjective by Agnew.
Mellifluous.
And Buckley is back with a hard three-syllable pronoun that brings Agnew up short. Both talkers circle each other, neither one taking the initiative at this time.
Tort.
And there's a short one-syllable adjective by Agnew.
Tawdry.
And another short one-syllable adjective by Agnew. And another short one-syllable adjective by Agnew. All three words hit their mark, and Buckley backpedals to his corner. Both talkers are sizing each other, waiting for that opening.
Ecology.
Buckley lands a two-syllable adverb which catches Agnew off guard.
Invective.
And a punishing three-syllable noun by the champion.
Tumultuous.
And two-syllable pronoun by the champion.
Well,
appears to be in trouble. A one-syllable noun by the champion.
Urban.
And a two-syllable pronoun, both
housing.
By the champion. A two-syllable noun and a two-syllable adverb, all by the champion, and Agnew is reeling. A two-syllable adjective, a one-syllable noun, a two-syllable preposition.
Respect.
And a hard conjunction, and the champion is pressing the attack.
Phantasmagoria.
An adverb by the champion.
Port.
And a noun, and Agnew is reeling.
Bicuspid.
Two-syllable
Stilt.
Adjective, a one-syllable noun.
Forensic.
A preposition.
Bloat.
An adverb, and an
Stilson
adjective, and Agnew
bilge.
Is down. Agnew is down. And there's another adverb,
desecrate.
A noun and a pronoun, and Agnew's tongue is wobbling in his mouth, but he is unable to talk.
Drunk.
An adjective, a conjunction,
Delicious.
A pronoun, and an adjective by the champion, and Agnew is trying desperately to talk, but his tongue is flopping around loosely in his
Surtitious.
Mouth, and his eyes are glazed. And the referee is stopping the fight. He is stopping the fight. It's all over. The fight is over. Agnew is unable to continue.
There have been a group of people, in fact, an overwhelming majority of Americans, who, although sickened by the violence and the dissent and the obnoxious appearances and attitudes of the dissenters themselves, have never been vocal in their opposition. Hence, they've come to be known as the great silent majority. These people believe in our system, and they love our country. They are loyal, patriotic, and above all, silent. Because of their inactivity, these people have generally been ignored by the previous administration. However, tonight, as a tribute to their great loyalty, the Vice President has chosen to honor a group of 700 members of the great silent majority who have gathered from all parts of the country to be here at the Grand Ballroom at the Statler Hilton.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States, Spiro T. Agnew.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Please, thank you. Gee, don't stop.
Ladies and gentlemen, members of the great silent majority, I'd just like, ladies and gentlemen, please. Ladies and gentlemen, please. Ladies and gentlemen, could we hold that down a little bit?
All right, I just like, please, will you hold down the noise? I'd like to say a few words.
Yes, silence, please.
Could you calm down? Could we have a little silence? A little silence. I would like to say a few. I can't hear myself think. Yeah. Hold it down, please. Please, could you keep it down? Silence. So, please, I can't. I don't know what's going on there. They don't let me talk.
Will you please take your seat?
Look. Are you gonna be quiet? Oh, let's go on. Please, let's have it quiet. Could we have a little silence down there? Am I asking too much?
Give them hell, Spiro. We all love you.
Shh. Please. Hold it up. Please. Ladies and gentlemen. I don't know, I can't. Could you get them down? Could you get them quiet?
I can't do it.
I don't see any reason for going on. Please, I'm trying. Please say, I can't say it. Please, will you hold that down? Forget it.
That was a delicious bouillabaisse. I must go into the kitchen and give my compliments to the chef. Where is the kitchen?
Through those swinging doors, monsieur.
I'm sorry.
It's your serve, Spiro. Ow! Stupid cock. Go ahead, Bobby. Tee off.
Hey, beauty, beauty. Okay, now you go ahead, Spiro.
States will officially start the All-Star game by tossing out the first ball. Oh, you wiener!
Well, we've been here an hour and I haven't seen a duck yet.
Look, all you have to do is blow this whistle and you'll see the ducks will come flying out. Watch.
Oh, gee!
I'm sorry.
This machine, Mr. Agnew, is what we call in layman's parlance our doomsday machine. It has one button. That button right there. When pressed, will activate all the nuclear weapons in the world, and a loud buzzing sound will be heard.
This means that all the nuclear weapons are being activated at the same time. The buzzing will last 1 minute, and then the end. All life on Earth as we know it will be totally destroyed, and the Earth itself will be blown out of its orbit.
This, of course, is a situation we hope will never come to pass. If the necessity becomes a reality, however, only the president will have the access to this button.
This button is the most dangerous button in the world.
You mean this button?
Mike, what have you done?
Oh, I'm sorry.
After Spiro Agnew pleaded nolo contendere to that tax evasion charge, he was fined $10,000 and placed on 3 years probation. He was also disbarred by the state of Maryland. After leaving politics, he worked as an international trade executive from homes in Rancho Mirage, California, and Ocean City, Maryland. He never spoke to Richard Nixon again, although he did attend Nixon's funeral in 1994. On September 17, 1996, Agnew died of leukemia in a hospital in Berlin, Maryland. He was 77 years old. That concludes this week's broadcast of Echoes of a Century. This program was an independent production by Doll Shoe Radio Creations, copyright 2005. Produced in the studios of WLSU La Crosse, an affiliate of Wisconsin Public Radio, on the La Crosse campus of the University of Wisconsin. I'm King David McKenzie. Thanks for listening. I hope that you'll join us again at the same time next week. Until then, remember, fear and God do not inhabit the same space.